Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. On issues of national security, which branch of government usually dominates? Well, it hasn't always been clear-cut throughout our history whether the judicial system would back up the executive branch in its wartime decisions. Dr. Amanda DiPaolo, an assistant professor of political science at MTSU, has written a new book called Zones of Twilight, Wartime Presidential Powers and Federal Court Decision-Making. It's published by Lexington Books, and it addresses the separation of powers and the balance of powers when America goes to war. Amanda, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your research finds that when the executive takes action during wartime, then the judiciary decides whether it was appropriate based on who has the authority to take action rather than whether the action was unconstitutional most of the time. So why does this occur?
Yeah, well, my research looks at when the executive limits individual liberties during times of war. So we would expect, as Americans, we would expect that the judiciary, when cases come before the court, they would decide these cases with the Bill of Rights in mind, using the language found in the Bill of Rights, but they don't. They use the separation of powers, as you said, which branch of government has authority to act. And there's a lot of reasons why this might take place, but predominantly I found that the judiciary is very careful not to limit the actions of the executive, because if they do, then not only could they make a mistake, they could make the wrong decision that would put national security at risk, but they could also weaken the judiciary branch itself if the president decides to ignore the ruling of the court, which today is very rare, but it could happen. So the court system will back up the president when our civil liberties are infringed upon, so long as Congress says okay.
So it's obviously not as simple as a rally round the flag boys kind of mentality that exists during wartime. It's more nuanced than that.
Yeah, you're right. We expect, initially, you would think that there is a rally around the flag effect, right? That the judiciary is just automatically going to, if they're not going to stick up for our civil liberties, because that's what the Constitution says they should do, they're going to just go with the executive. But they really do look to see whether or not Congress is on board with the president's actions.
And so in that way, they really are concerned about the tripartite balance of powers. It's not a judicial power grab, and it's not the judiciary trying to side with the executive over Congress more one than the other. It's still a balancing act, even though it leans a little more toward the executive.
Yes, absolutely.
You also cite some examples in which parts of the Bill of Rights are not applicable or at least not absolute during a time of war, specific amendments within the first 10. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, within the context of the cases that I've chosen?
Yeah, there was a particular part, I believe it was in the introduction, that talks about this will come out in post-production.
Like the Third Amendment quartering soldiers?
Oh, yeah, the Third Amendment prohibiting the quartering of soldiers in time of peace, the Fifth Amendment guaranteeing a civil trial, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there are parts of the Bill of Rights that actually are written in a way to suggest that in a time of war things might be different. So the Third Amendment, you're not allowed to quarter soldiers without congressional legislation in a time of peace, which would suggest that in a time of war, quartering soldiers may actually be appropriate. And I mentioned that in the introduction only to suggest that we should be cognizant of the fact that the Bill of Rights, even though there is just one Bill of Rights, not two, one for peace and one for war, it may be legitimate for the court to actually take the separation of powers road instead of using the language in the Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm. After the attacks of September 11th in 2001, the federal government took some actions which raised the ire of civil libertarians. The Patriot Act increased searching at airports, treatment of detainees at Guantanamo, warrantless wiretaps. I believe there's an entire chapter in there in your book dedicated to warrantless wiretaps. But because although all of these actions were called unprecedented at the time, this is really not the first time in our history that this kind of controversy has arisen. People always talk about Lincoln suspending habeas corpus as one example. Could you give us some historical context for these types of conflicts when this sort of thing butts up against another civil liberties versus the need to protect the nation?
Well, every president from Washington forward believes that they can actually take liberties with the Constitution when national security is at stake. One of my favorite examples to talk about is John Adams. He passed the Sedition Act, or he asked Congress to pass the Sedition Act. And if you were writing anything that was negative about the government, you would get thrown in jail. Mm-hmm. It was law that they could take you and throw you in jail. You had no free speech when it came to sedition against the government.
Diametrically opposed to the First Amendment to the Constitution.
That's right. Now, the thing is, the Sedition Act never actually came up in the court system. So it was never decided whether or not it was constitutional or not. But there was a war going on, the quasi-war with France. And Republicans were getting chucked in jail. And so when Thomas Jefferson, who was a Republican, he got into office, he let the Sedition Act expire, right? As opposed to today, with the warrantless wiretapping that you had mentioned, Congress sanctioned George Bush's decision to set up this NSA wiretapping program. And the Patriot Act got amended to include this sort of thing when President Obama got into office. Those sections of the Patriot Act were set to expire, and he asked Congress to renew them. Mm-hmm. And they were, in fact, renewed. So you would think that the Democratic president, who ran largely against the foreign policy initiatives of George W. Bush, you would think when he got into office, he would do things differently. But he hasn't. And the reason why he hasn't is largely because, as I said, all the presidents believe that when national security is an issue, then our Bill of Rights might not be as secure as we think they are.
You're a political scientist, and it's easier these days for presidents to have at their disposal more sophisticated means of taking the temperature of the American people than were available in the past. To what extent does the executive branch weigh public opinion, or what it perceives to be public opinion, in trying to arrive at these decisions about where their power, how far they can push the envelope during wartime?
Well, I can tell you for a fact that George Bush's administration didn't care what the public thought at all. Bush honestly believed that he knew what he was doing, and maybe he did. I'm not saying he didn't, but he and his administration honestly believed that they knew what they were doing, and that not to make fun, but he was the decider, right? He said, it's my job as president to make these decisions. And so you have Dick Cheney, who, with only 6 months left in office, goes on primetime TV being interviewed. And when he's told, look, 70% of the people in America don't agree with your tactics in CIA secret prisons and harsh interrogation methods. And when he's asked to respond about that, he says, well, it doesn't matter what they think. We're here to protect the people, and we're going to make those sorts of decisions. Mm-hmm. I don't know yet. It's too early to say how President Obama, how he uses public opinion polls. But everything that Bill Clinton did in domestic and foreign affairs, he took the temperature of the people. So it varies from president to president, and they absolutely, especially our modern presidents, have every tool at their disposal to know what the public wants. But they're not elected to do what the public wants. Right. They're elected to govern the country the way that it has to be governed.
Mm-hmm. The very definition of war has come under scrutiny in recent years. Some people complain that war is now just a political term of art. The war on drugs, the war on terrorism. It's not the same thing as World War II. There's a difference there. Rather than something more concretely related to nation states. So now our military engagements are asymmetrical warfare. against loosely connected networks of enemy combatants, if you want to use that term. How has this impacted the separation of powers question? Can you make the argument that the rules of the game changed now that we're in asymmetrical warfare and at war not so much with nation states as with these more nebulous entities?
I'm not sure. I would say that if we have employed our troops abroad on a large scale, that they're fighting a war. When their lives are in jeopardy, they're fighting a war. Absolutely, with the attacks on 9/11, what emerged was an asymmetric fight. We were fighting a terrorist organization, a non-state actor, not a state actor. Whether or not that affects the separation of powers is an interesting question because, of course, as you know, Congress is the branch of government that is supposed to declare war in the first place, but even though our troops have been sent abroad over 200 times, the Congress has only declared war 5 times, and every other time it has been in the executive branch's agenda. They're the ones who initiate sending the troops abroad, and most of the time Congress passes some sort of resolution or a law that backs the president up, but no declaration of war, and the Supreme Court has okayed that. Mm-hmm. From very early on, during the quasi-war with France, is the first time we got these questions, what does war mean?
Right.
And it was back in 1801 when the Supreme Court said, if Congress has passed a law saying that the troops can be sent abroad, then that's fine. And so that's what's happened here again today. Since the 9 days after the terrorist attacks, the Congress passed the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, and President Bush used that from day one to say, this is my authorization from Congress to start military action. And it called for it. The AUMF says, we're giving the president the authority to use all necessary means and all necessary force to bring those who are responsible for the attacks, bring them to justice. Mm-hmm.
So if it's you can look at things as isolated incidents, like the bombing of the barracks in Lebanon, the Marine barracks in Lebanon, which I believe happened during the Reagan administration,
yeah,
or the bombing of the USS Cole, which happened during the Bush administration, or Clinton? Okay, happened during the Clinton administration. You can see these things as separate, isolated incidents, or you can see them as part of the greater whole of warfare against Al-Qaeda, Hamas, whomever happens to be responsible. And it still doesn't really matter. It's whenever American fighting, so men and women are in harm's way, that constitutes war.
For the United States.
For the United States. Let's see. I wanted to follow up with it. Does the change in the definition or perception of the word war work to the executive's advantage? Does it necessarily give the executive a built-in advantage over
absolutely
the other two branches in when this happens?
The executive, absolutely. Because, first of all, just to add to my previous one-word answer.
Yeah.
Terrorist organizations, when they attack barracks or when they attack ships, they're attacking military, right? So those are acts of war. Those really aren't acts of terrorism. Those are acts of war by a non-state actor. When they blow up airplanes and hit buildings and all these casualties are civilians, then it's a terrorist attack, right? But for these individuals, for these organizations that we label terrorists, and they are. I'm not saying that they're not. But when they blow up barracks and ships, those are acts of war. And so they are already at war. Al-Qaeda has said for years they're at war with America. It's just America hadn't been participating.
Mm-hmm. And so if the civilian flight, which had crashed at Shanksville, had slammed into the White House or the Congress as we believe was the intention, then that would have just driven the point home that much more. One plane did slam into the Pentagon.
Yes.
The embarrassing and tragic as that was, the home of the Defense Department of the United States, that is about as direct as you can get. Let me ask about, again, on the definition of war. Why haven't we achieved greater clarity on this issue, at least since Vietnam, which during the 60s was denounced by the anti-war movement as illegal because there was no formal congressional declaration of war? Is that another term of art, declaration of war? Because that phrase isn't in the Constitution anywhere. Do we declare war? Yeah.
It's in the Constitution.
Wow.
Congress has the authority in Article 1, Section 8.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking that there was no real declaration of war for Korea, and there's no real declaration of war for Vietnam. So is it incumbent upon Congress to back the president up to declare war? It does not seem as though there have been some instances where the executive and the legislative didn't agree on whether or not we really were at war, but the issue was just sort of hanging in the mist over the American public. And the ideological differences played themselves out, at least with Vietnam, in demonstrations and protest and maybe on talk shows. But wasn't very much clarity about who actually has the right to make a declaration of war.
Well, Korea is actually a really interesting example because Truman didn't go to Congress for a declaration. He didn't get approval from Congress. Congress asked him, hey, do you want us to declare war, to officially declare war for you? And he said, I don't need it, because I have a UN resolution. It was the only Security Council resolution during the Cold War and to actually send troops somewhere. And so Korea is a really interesting situation because the president said, I have the international community. I don't even need you, Congress. But again, only 5 times in our nation's history have we officially declared war, but we have been in so many military fights abroad. I think Vietnam is maybe like a larger one, and since it's so controversial, that brings up these issues. How do we define war? Should we be declaring all these situations? From my perspective, I look only at the legality of it from the Supreme Court's opinion, because it's the Supreme Court who actually interprets the Constitution. They're the ones, like it or not, who make these decisions. Mm-hmm. They are. And ever since the start of the nation, they said that you don't have to have a declaration of war from Congress. You just need Congress to pass an authorization to send troops. Mm-hmm. And in almost all of our military battles, we do have some sort of congressional backing. Again, Korea being an obvious outlier.
And the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, the closest thing, I guess, for Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah, in 64. That, incidentally, that speech was given at Syracuse University, which is where I did my PhD.
One of the Supreme Court cases you talk about a lot in the book is Youngstown Cheatin' Tube v. Sawyer, and this is interesting for a couple of reasons. Your colleague, Dr. Karen Peterson, and you have received a one-year Tennessee Board of Regents grant that will let you analyze Justice Robert Jackson's concurring opinion in the case. Actually, it'll pay for an adjunct professor to teach some classes that will give you all time to do what you need to do. Talk about what that research is about and why the case is applicable to the subject of Zones of Twilight.
Okay. The grant actually was given to us last year.
It was
last
year.
So we've already started the process of, we've had the time off, and we've started the process of our initial research. My Zones of Twilight book is about the Supreme Court. And so we've decided to take it a step further, and I have case studies. Mm-hmm. Dr. Peterson does quantitative analysis, mm-hmm. Runs regressions, and all the statistics that I can't wrap my mind around.
Yeah, Karen is the numbers cruncher in this work.
She is the numbers cruncher. I am the court case collector. Mm-hmm. And what we've decided is to take my initial research a step further and add the lower court opinions. Look at the district court opinions and look at the court of appeals opinions, because there are a lot more cases. There are a lot of cases dealing with national security that the Supreme Court just won't touch, mm-hmm. and the lower courts do. And if the Supreme Court says, no, we're not going to hear that case, then the lower court opinion stands. So we want to look at these lower court opinions, and we've started our analysis about this, to see whether or not Justice Jackson's framework is correct. Now, I say that the framework is correct in Zones of Twilight for the Supreme Court, that there are three pegs or prongs of judicial decision making. The Supreme Court is going to absolutely, not 100%, but predominantly, side with the executive if Congress backs him up. That's the first prong. The second one is that if they're not sure, if it's unclear who in the Constitution has authority to act, the Supreme Court is going to look for cooperation amongst the branches, or the Supreme Court is going to invite cooperation amongst the branches if it doesn't already exist. The third branch is when the president acts contrary to the wishes of Congress. And when the president acts contrary to the wishes of Congress, the Supreme Court always strikes down the executive's actions. So this is what I found in the Supreme Court analysis. We are checking out to see if it's the same for the lower federal courts.
Can you talk a little bit about what the Youngstown case was all about, just your basic synopsis?
I would love to. This is my favorite case for the Supreme Court. In 1950, the Steelworkers of America were going on strike. Mm-hmm. And the president, Truman, he asked them not to go on strike. So they gave him a little bit of leeway. They said, okay, we're going to wait 6 months. We're going to try to work out something, and if we can't do it, we'll let you know. So they don't work anything out. 9 months later, they give him 1 day's notice. They say, in 24 hours, we're going on strike. So President Truman decided, he thought about this, and he thought, you know what, we are involved in a war right now, and I can't let all the steel workers stop working, because that's how we get our ammunition and our weapons.
We need the steel for the military materiel.
That's right. So he told his secretary to nationalize the steel mills. So the labor secretary said, okay, and this is Charles Sawyer, now all of a sudden the steel mills of America are under the ownership of the American government. And this is kind of scandalous because there was no sort of, you know, it wasn't an eminent domain case. They were nationalizing an entire industry. They weren't taking the property away, you know, a building away.
And during the Cold War, to a great many people, this smacked of socialism.
Oh, it sure did. Mm-hmm. It sure did. And so the steel mill owners sued the government saying, we want our businesses back. And the case went very quickly through the court system at the Supreme Court level. President Truman thought for sure he was going to win because all nine justices were appointed by either himself or FDR. So we're talking about an entire court of Democrats. Mm-hmm. And he was a Democratic president. He thought that this was a shoo-in. So he was extremely shocked when the court came back and said, look, Mr. President, you're not allowed to write the law. Congress writes the law. You execute it. By nationalizing the steel mills, you're writing a policy. This is a law. Mm-hmm. And so the court said, if Congress had done so, it would have been okay.
Because that's their job.
Because that is their job. That's right. And they didn't do it. And so Justice Jackson's concurring opinion, he's agreeing, of course, with the court, you have to give back the steel mills because you didn't have congressional authorization. But he wanted to outline for that executive and future executives what needs to take place for you to get approval in these sorts of situations from the court.
So he went into specifics about how future executives, future chief executives should proceed if they find themselves in similar circumstances.
Yeah, he doesn't actually say this is for future circumstances. What he says is this is how it's always been. Mm-hmm. And that's why I decided I was going to test that theory. I was going to take all the national security cases and figure out if they actually fit these prongs, if they really do decide cases where individual liberties are limited, do they decide it using the separation of powers like Justice Jackson suggests that they do? And he's right, they did. So that's why I say that it's for future presidents. You need to ask Congress. And we saw that during the war on terrorism cases, the early ones, when George Bush, he set up military commissions. And he didn't have congressional authorization. He tried to argue that the AUMF was enough authorization.
He wanted the enemy combatants to be tried by military tribunals instead of in civilian courts, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And the Supreme Court said, we're not opposed to that if Congress set up the military commissions. You can't do it yourself. Right. So he said, well, they did. They said I can because they said I can use all necessary means to fight the people who did this. But the court said we want specifics. And so 6 months later, the Congress in 2006, they passed the Military Commission Act. The Supreme Court said you don't have congressional authorization. Mm-hmm. So President Bush asked Congress, give me authorization. They did. And then now we have these military commissions where some individuals, slowly but surely, are in fact getting tried.
Yeah. Is this the same Justice Jackson who was known for his involvement in the Nuremberg trials?
The one and only.
That's the one.
Yes.
Portrayed admirably by Spencer Tracy. I'm an old movie fan. Never mind. can you talk about some other Supreme Court cases that are directly on point that you have found and that are related to this very subject? You said you're the case collector. Have you collected any others in addition to Youngstown that you found particularly interesting?
Well, I think that Korematsu versus United States is an easy one to mention because most people have heard of it. During World War II, when the governor of California, who was Earl Warren, who would become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he decided it was a good idea if the military took all the individuals of Japanese origin or ancestry and kicked them out of military areas in the West Coast. And the military thought that was a good idea, right? So Congress passed a resolution allowing that to take place.
Okay.
And we typically think, when we grow up learning about this case, we assume, unless you've read it, that it's the Supreme Court just agreeing with the executive, and in this case, it's the military officials.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It's not. Congress passed the resolution that said if FDR wants to do this, he can. And the same day the resolution gets passed, because obviously they spoke about it and it was something that they wanted, but it started with Congress.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones who passed the resolution first. And so when the case comes to the Supreme Court, can you kick people out of their homes? The Supreme Court said, look, last year, in another case, we already said that the curfew is okay, that we can tell you you have to be in your home from 6 p.m. till 8 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
We can tell you that. Why? Because Congress said it was okay. Well, if Congress said it was okay to give people a curfew, then we're also going to say it's okay that Congress said you can... you can exclude people from certain areas of the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so these are, in our opinion today, extremely controversial decisions.
Right.
Very restrictive on our individual liberties.
It might seem that this entire argument, simplistically, might be asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, because the chief executive, the president of the United States, is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. But it's important to have these discussions about separation of powers during wartime, because we would like to avoid, as a nation, of course, say, for example, a 7 days in May type scenario where a rogue elephant in the Pentagon takes advantage of, say, an unpopular chief executive or a president who is perceived as weak to, for all intents and purposes, declare his own little mini war and start a coup d'etat, or have a situation occur in reverse whereby the executive decides to haul off and do whatever he believes is within his purview without the consultation of Congress. These are very important types of boundaries to be considered.
Yeah, that's right. And that sort of kind of happened during the Civil War when Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus. He had military officials on his side who were taking extreme liberties with who were getting arrested and held without any charges coming up against them. And cases went to court about this, and Lincoln lost, and at the end of the day, he stood by his military officials.
Mm-hmm.
he would not give the writ of habeas corpus, even though the court had told him he had to. So he actually ignored the Circuit Court of Appeals, not the Supreme Court. And but it was, I don't want to say a rogue military official, but there were a couple who were taking liberties with these commands that Lincoln had set out. It was in no way his intention for extremely innocent people who really had nothing to do with the military to get thrown in prison indefinitely.
Yeah. Did you write your book for the academic community in terms of the readership, or do you think that the general public would find it just as accessible as the academic community?
Initially, I wrote it as my dissertation for my PhD. Mm-hmm. I revised it to take out all the stuff that was kind of boring that you have to put in to get the degree, but that nobody really cares about.
Right.
And so it took a lot of editing. I also took out all the jargon that you learn when you're reading the cases or studying the judiciary. So I tried to make it as accessible to anyone who is interested in the war powers as possible. I've tried to. I'm not sure if it's successful or not.
Well, I think it's very interesting, and I hope that I've done it justice here today. I know that you have. It's called Zones of Twilight, Wartime Presidential Powers and Federal Court Decision-Making by Dr. Amanda DiPaolo. And if you want to contact Dr. DiPaolo, her email address at MTSU is DiPaolo, DiPaolo, at mtsu.edu. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please be sure and join us at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're also available on iTunes.